Hello, everyone, and welcome to another very, very special episode of the Gestalten podcast. My name is Martin, and I am the managing director here at Concept House and also your pretty much now daily host or like weekly host of the Gestalten podcast. And for everybody who's asking the question again, I am not by myself. I have a very, very special guest. This very, very special guest is unfortunately not Eric because Eric is on holiday. But I would like to very, very much welcome the, I would have to say, almost celebrity recently with all the kind of footage that you've gotten in terms of the media. A very, very warm welcome to Carlos Salaf.
How you doing, Martin and crew? Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it. It's cool to talk for a bit.
Yeah, we're very, very excited actually to have you on board as a whole thing. We've been looking forward to this actually for quite some time because there's not that many people that have done what you've been doing over the past few years, that we will jump into this pretty much in the next few minutes. But why don't you tell our listeners or give them a little bit of an overview, what you've been doing and over the past, 10 years or pretty much in your career. And of course, what you've been doing as a little bit of an overview over the past, like say, 2-3 years.
Sure. Well, I've been designing and currently I'm building a bespoke supercar company. So it's more about kind of an artist patron type of relationship where I work directly with the client to create something beautiful that's sort of tailored to them. And that's currently what I'm doing. But I was working in the industry for a while. I worked at Mazda for the longest stretch. That was from 2003 to 2012. And That was in the Southern California design studio, in Irvine, California. And that was really a special time to be there for sure. It was a time when Ford, had some, ownership from a corporate standpoint in Mazda, and there was this kind of cross-pollination happening with the leadership of Lawrence Vandenacker, kind of bringing his style sensibilities and design sensibilities and bringing that together with some of the discipline and passion, from the Japanese side, and they were allowing us to do a lot of exploration, and that was a wonderful time to be there. And I feel really just grateful that I was able to experience that. I would say after a while working in the industry, I wanted to do something more independent, and as many of us do, and try something. Maybe I'm just a glutton for punishment and always want to do it the hard way. But I wanted to try something and go out on a limb and create a structure where I could express myself more artistically.
Yeah. I mean, we have to be very, very honest. I mean, I can say this from my own personal experience. A lot of designers, especially within the car industry, they're working for the big companies and let's say they're very comfortable and their kind of biggest challenge or what they really want to do is to create their own car. Might not be a supercar, might be any kind of car that you can imagine, but let's be straightforward here. Not a lot of them and almost none of them actually has the balls to do that straight up. Yeah. And say look, I'm doing my own car. So what was it that really pushed you to say, look, I'm leaving Mazda now and I'm going to do my own car or my own company that, builds cars for, on a bespoke level?
Yeah. I don't know if it's balls or just something I felt like I just had to do. It's something I started obsessing about probably around 2008. And, once I had an opportunity to leave in a responsible manner where I could support my family, around 2012. So it took a little while till I was able to do it, but that was still the dream. And I had a little seed money that I could use at that time to start to build this. And I just felt like it was just a fire in me that if I didn't do it, I'd feel like I'd be a miserable asshole. And I would just, be just not happy person, an unhappy person if I didn't try to pursue this and see what happens. And, I feel like it's still definitely a work in progress. There are tons of things I see that I want to improve or change, in many respects, but it's sort of one day at a time. And I'm still here. I haven't died in the process yet. So, you know, one day at a time and, you know, plugging away. But, yeah, it was definitely something that I am very passionate about and felt like I would really regret if I didn't try.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, give us a little bit of an insight, because like most of the people listening to the podcast and like, you know, they work within studios or they have at least studio experience. Now, it sounds to me from everything that I've seen, and obviously you shared a lot of stuff on social media, gave the people a little bit of an insight. You obviously had a team behind you, but what was that really for you? Like, you know, the situation was like, look, this is what I had to do. I mean, everybody knows you can sketch. What did you do? I mean, did you start doing like 3D modeling yourself? Like, did you have any kind of, you know, clay that you've been working with? Or how can we imagine, like, you know, Carlos starting up his own company and building his own car?
Man, Martin, it wasn't a linear process for me at all.
Well, you mean no Mazda process at all?
Well, some of that, yes. Some of it, no. I kind of took with me what I knew from, you know, the way the industry does it, and also thought about ways I could bypass some of that as well, and also ways I could bootstrap it with the much smaller resources that I have. So the first idea that I had was actually when I started to build this electric supercar that is the C1 model. I don't say it was, because it's still something I hope to get back to soon, but it's the C1 model with the central driving position. And originally that was going to be all electric. And I started building that in the computer first, just 3D modeling it and sketching it. And process-wise, because I don't have to convince somebody to make my design, I did a lot of just quick chicken scratch and then threw it into the computer and quickly worked on just to see if it would work in 3D. And very quickly you realize a lot of those ideas just don't work in 3D, and you go back and you go, and you kind of sketch around and a little more chicken scratch. Maybe this will work, maybe that'll work. And I find that process very liberating and fast, just being able to work directly in 3D with 2D, sketching just real quickly. And I took that, I made an early model, took sections from that, and actually my first work was actually right into full size with cardboard sections and plaster. Yeah. And I started to build a fuselage form with that. And I think after a while I thought, you know, this is not exactly the direction I want to go. I want to try doing this actually with aluminum and actually bringing in some old school handmade process and do it. So I made not linear at all. So I made I laser cut a buck, full size buck, and started working on that with a partner, who does aluminum work here in Ohio. Pete's coach building, that they do a lot of Porsche stuff, a lot of restoration work. And I saw that he had a clear understanding of the 3D process. And if I gave him a buck, he could work with that, a pattern, so to speak. And we worked on that for several months while I was working on a chassis from scratch. I made models out of balsa wood of the chassis of the frame and worked out suspension kinematics, and then realized that there's stuff with roll centers and suspension geometry that is just beyond me in terms of experience. And brought on another guy who started to build the chassis. And long story short, that ended up being a disaster. And that person, let's just say that it was a disappointment. And I lost a lot of time and money working on that. And that was the first really hard kind of gut check. Like, do I want to keep doing this, you know, or do I go back and get a job again? And that thought to me was just unthinkable. So just pooled together resources and decided, okay, I'm going to put that one on the back burner right now. And I'm going to work on something completely different. I have other ideas in my sort of mental reservoir. You know, as a designer, you just have so many ideas pent up all the time that you need to express. Yeah. So I was like, well, this is an opportunity to express something different. But this time I'm going to use an existing chassis, which I guess mm-hmm. is like what the smart money does, but I had to do it the hard way first. And so I decided on a Lambo chassis just because of a Gallardo chassis specifically, to make it a coach yeah. build and work with a chassis that's really well flogged, so to speak. It's been in racing. It's a, you know, well-tuned machine and has a beautiful engine, which is really bulletproof. And I thought, yeah. you know, that's got a lot of room for, and it comes in a manual, you know, yeah, a lot of
very
room
important.
For, yeah, a lot of latitude creatively that, you know, things you could do with that, and felt it was a good canvas for an exterior design as well. So that's the way that I went with that. And
how did you
remember what the original question was, to be honest?
that's fine. That's all good. That's all good. My question, obviously, I mean, how did you decide on the Lambo? Was that just by chance because, like, you know, you like the proportions, or like, you know, like you like the wheelbase, or you like, let's say, the customization that you can do with it, or because especially here in Germany, just to give you a little bit of an idea, the probably preferred car to do something similar to what you did is the Audi R8. Mm-hmm. Because it's so easily customizable. You have especially some, you know, parts such as the side mirrors and stuff like that. They're so complicated to get approved over here in Europe, is that they're saying, look, those are looking nice, they work, like, you know, we can just leave it all in the same. So the people use them for very practical reasons, and, you know, because it's easy to customize. What was your main motivation to use a Lambo and maybe not, like, you know, I don't know, like a McLaren or a Ferrari? And I want to say, besides the financial points, because I think if we start talking about the financials in detail, you know, you've probably used, or you might have used a different car.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge part of it. I mean, the McLaren tub is such a nice thing to build around, and it's very compact and you can build subframes for it. So that might've been it. But then again, I wanted a more kind of emotional engine, something that could be naturally aspirated still if people wanted that. And, you know, I liked the manual transmission as an option. So I did the Gallardo just kept coming back, and I thought about the, just the availability of that car as well. They made quite mm-hmm. a few, 14,000 of them. So they're quite plentiful. They're quite modular compared to other cars. The transmission engines, as I said, are very stout. They can take a lot. I mean, people are turbocharging them here to like 1,000, 2,000 horsepower, and they don't explode. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot you can do with it, and I like that you can also make it a full-on race car if you want to do that. So that became the choice. And then why not an R8? I did look at the R8 as well, but I felt like from a proportion standpoint, really the only part that I used from the exterior is the glass and mm-hmm. the front area of the roof rail. Everything else went, but on the Gallardo, I preferred the profile of the roof for what I wanted to express, and the proportions of the cabin. The R8 is quite a bit larger, and didn't quite have the gesture that I was after to build around.
I mean, that brings me to exactly that kind of question. I mean, you know, when I look into the car, it has, from my perspective, some very, very good inspiration from, you know, let's say the Ferrari F40, for example, some of the older Italian cars, very, very traditional, very actually simple in that kind of sense. Where did your inspiration come from making the C2 in particular, of course? What was your intention? Where was the inspiration coming from? And, you know, what is it that you wanted to show when this car was then presented at Pebble Beach?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been interested in contrasting ideas. And with this car, it was exploring vintage values in modern design. So I wanted to bring in my love of old racing cars, and thus you have the manual shifting and the naturally aspirated V10 and a lot of the cues that I brought into the interior with real aluminum, you know, switches and the distressed leather. A lot of that is really expressed in the interior. The exterior is quite a modern statement, I would say, but you know, and on that side of things, I wanted to see what I could do with construction of the body that was different. And that's obviously going to be polarizing, but I wanted to do something more architectural and see if I could, you know, really hone in on this blend between tessellated geometric surfaces and blends between the surfaces. Whereas traditionally you have Lamborghini, for example, doing these stealth-like surfaces, and then you have Ferrari doing more kind of sinuous, or Jaguar doing more kind of sinuous surfaces. And I wanted to explore a contrast kind of in the middle that explores both sides and marries those two things. And so, yeah, in the interior you have these kind of modern take on toggle switches and, and then, manual shifting. And on the exterior you have this really tessellated kind of stark in some ways statement. And I just really like the idea of blending those kind of contrasting ideas together.
Yeah. I mean, I do have to say, it's just, it is very impressive. Yeah. From a purely, of course, let's say design perspective, because it is also a bold statement, from that side, but also, and I want to kind of bring this in. And I think from your experience to give a little bit back, obviously to the younger people, for example, as well.
Yeah.
Eric and I, last time when we had a podcast and when we recorded the podcast, we were talking about design schools and, you know, about what they teach, what they maybe don't teach. And let's use the example of you doing your own project as the advanced version of the design school, and, you know, producing your own car. What was the most rewarding thing for you in the whole process, and what was almost like, you know, something that might have almost broke you in terms of, you know, complexity or in terms of a learning process? Because I can imagine that, you know, doing something like that and actually then bringing it onto the road or bringing it into kind of Pebble Beach is, and you mentioned this of course as well, is not a really smooth process right away.
Wow. Yeah. It's, immediately when you, well, I'll just speak from my own experience doing this. I was immediately taken out of my silo working at a car company, where you're in charge of one aspect, maybe a part of the exterior, maybe a whole part of the exterior or the interior. And they're usually separate. And then that's separate from engineering, and that's separate from project management, separate from PR, from vendor relations. There's just so many things that I didn't appreciate about the way that a company functions, and just finding trustworthy people to work with. I mean, that was a really painful experience for me. Just, you know, having people that originally when I started that were just really disappointing and really, really screwed me over on some things. And I just had to get smarter and, you know, wiser. And it wasn't the things that I expected that would be the challenging things. And, you know, it was definitely relationships became the top thing, you know, finding people that I really could trust, and in every aspect. And man, there's just been so many things that nearly broke me, but it's just that feeling of regret I would have if I didn't just finish and push through it. You know, I don't have that in me to just quit something. I have to keep pushing. But there were so many things. I mean, you know, some things were just logistics, timing, you know, like getting out to Pebble Beach was just insane. Like just the logistics of getting it from city to city to be worked on. It went from Ohio to Austin, Texas to Seaside, which is near Monterey, then to Monterey. And we were working on it through the night until it loaded on the truck the next day, like every last minute. And that was a pit stop that wasn't even supposed to happen. We were supposed to have it done like 3 days before that, and then just like chill out and drink martinis and, you know, until the show, right? But that's not how it went. And I had to, you know, call on my homies to just come up and just help me make it happen. And they did. They came through. And it's all part of the journey, you know. And, you know, there's just been so many times where I'm like, I don't know how this is going to happen, but somehow you just keep going and you just do it, you know. Somehow, yeah. I don't know. There's no playbook for this. And every day I'm still figuring it out. I haven't, I can't say that I figured it out. I'm just, but that's something that just going back to school real quick, that's something that you don't learn in school, but what you do learn is the skills necessary to do it. That perseverance of getting your projects done and pulling all nighters and just that kind of gut, just that fortitude, you know, and that just figuring out a way, you know?
A very, very personal question in that kind of regards. And, you know, how did this project, let's say, affect your professional image? Yeah. Because I know people that start companies and they're being like called like, you know, lunatics and crazy people and like, you know, what the freaking shit are you doing? You know? But obviously with all the kind of really positive media coverage that came out of after Pebble Beach and stuff like that, and, you know, receiving a lot of praise. I mean, how was that? How do you think you're now perceived? I mean, do people say like, look, this is a great thing that you did, and like, you know, like every praise you deserve? Are people jealous about what you did in a positive way and in a negative way, of course? Or are you still seen, or, you know, not still, but are you seen a little bit as an outsider who kind of quit on the industry to kind of do his own thing? Or how do you see yourself now, like with, let's say, 5 years or so under your belt of doing your own stuff?
Wow, that's a really good question. I find personally that I just can't think about it too much. I can't think too much about what people perceive of me. I am a pretty sensitive person, so when people say mean shit, it does affect me. So, like, you know, like when I was on the concept lawn at Pebble Beach, I heard the praise. I heard, you know, some really moving things actually from people who had been going there a long time, and that meant a lot to me. You know, and then I remember, like, one of the nights right after Pebble, I was just surfing the web and somebody was saying some really, really just hurtful things, mean shit. And I was just, you know, really hurt by that. And I was like, wow, I guess I was in a bubble. And there are a lot of people that are just, you know, that, you know, are shitting on it. But, you know, I just can't, I realize I just can't worry about what people think. And of course, like the praise and, you know, like the praise from my peers means the most to me, you know, for people in the industry, you know, just their encouragement means a lot to me, you know, and my, you know, my family and my friends, but I just can't worry too much about how I'm perceived, you know, from others. And, I can't work and think about the future when that, like, that's in my head, you know?
I mean, just to kind of get onto that, because you've mentioned, like, you know, you've worked with some really, really amazing people such as Lawrence Vandenacker, you know, Julien Montous, I think Derry Jenkins as well, and all those kind of guys. So, you know, when you look into the car right now, in terms of the development as well, where did those characters, those, you know, let's say those guys and their personality affect you the most, A, within, let's say, the creative process of the car, but also in terms of the actual execution, you know, like, you know, Lawrence Vandenacker is like this kind of calm, cool guy. Like, obviously he can go crazy if he wants to, but, you know, like, he has this kind of coolness with him where he's just like, okay, let's make this as a decision. You know, did you think about, you know, your past with those kind of guys and learning from them while doing the car?
I didn't think about it too much while I was working on the car, but if I think back, they're all of them, all those guys have contributed to my growth as a designer. Like, I would say Franz taught me a ton just about design, about the discipline of design, how to make something work and look at proportion in the surface. And Lawrence definitely had this way of pushing you to, like, explore, you know, and until you kind of break out of the original idea that, you know, you thought was it, you know, and to find something better. And, you know, all those guys that you mentioned have been very influential on me, and I'm grateful to have spent the time around them that I did.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, again, I mean, you know, we cannot say this, you know, big enough. You've actually, you know, gotten to the point is where you have a, you know, a proper car standing at the lawn at Pebble Beach. And the really, really big thing is not just to have the car, but also to go to Pebble Beach. So how did that actually happen? Because I know Pebble Beach is a very, very exclusive event. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So where did the idea come from your perspective? Let's present it at Pebble Beach. Was that someone at Pebble Beach coming up to you and just like, hey, look, we've seen your project. Do you want to present it here? Did you apply for it? Or how can we, you know, see that kind of, let's call it the PR marketing process of Carlos coming in. It's like, right. Oh yeah, shit, we have to finish the car, but yeah, we have to do some marketing for it as well.
Exactly. And it's in they totally go in parallel. So you're thinking about things kind of, you have to sort of compartmentalize throughout the day, you know, while you do things. But that's something that started, I went to Pebble Beach in 2010, and that was, so I just had this feeling at that when I went there. I was like, someday I'd love to have my car on this concept lawn. Mm-hmm. It would just be such an awesome achievement. And it was a dream, I guess, just sort of an emotional gut kind of level of dream. And later on, I sort of, as I was developing this car and thinking about this whole vintage values and modern design theme, I thought more and more Pebble would be a really great fit because of that celebration of the past, you know, and the showcase of the modern that they do every year. And I reached out to the director there, Sean Jacobs at Pebble Beach, and just I showed him an article that I had gotten into Rob Report magazine when I first sort of shared this with the world outside of social media. And he saw that article, and I think from that he could see that it would be a cool thing to do, and it would be a good fit. And so, yeah, from there, just we developed a plan and got it there. So it's, I think it was just that we both felt like it was mutually a cool thing to do that would elevate both brands, you know. And I think a lot of it is just that it's finding partners on the way.
Yeah.
Especially when you're bootstrapping the way I did, you know, people always ask about how'd you do it? Like from a financial standpoint, but you can throw money at a lot of things, but, you know, if you have it, but if you don't have as much, you really have to, you have to bring people on that share the vision and want to pitch their, you know, and pitch in their creativity.
Yeah.
And I think just by getting out there and doing what I was doing and showing the process of doing this and not hiding it.
Yeah.
People saw what I was doing and got excited about it and wanted to take part in it. And just by going and getting out there, that's how I was able to find some of the amazing people that I worked with who were part of the development team, you know, and to get this out there.
Yeah. And I think you've just mentioned one very, very important thing that is that comes up in the kind of conversations that, you know, we internally have here as well, is that, you know, when you're in this big kind of corporation, you don't even realize how much money is being spent and almost, you know, and also being wasted. Let's be very, very honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah?
And if you don't have the money to spend in you know, in that big amount, then you have to be also quite efficient in that sense. And you have to find some, you know, trickery as well in terms of what looks nice and what looks real, but maybe isn't 100% real.
Show the vision, and that's, you know, that's the biggest thing I would say.
So, if somebody would come up to you, yeah, and would ask, Carlos, I have the same kind of idea. What kind of, let's say, three big tips would you, you know, give them on the way to say, just like, look, I can give you three experience, like, you know, three big experience from my personal point of view that you should really, let's not worry about, but be aware about.
Yeah, I would say just get started and start to build it. If it means working on it at home on the computer, building models, get it, put together a vision, and then share it with people. Don't hide it. Like originally, I remember I thought about this a lot because in the car industry, the strategy is always to hide something into the last minute, you know, and then ta-da at the auto show, you show everybody, the cover comes off, and then I thought, you know, there's a lot more value in me actually just showing people the process and showing people what I'm doing and getting my, you know, my creativity out into the world. And I really believe that was so key. And there are a lot of designers that are just incredible, and they have their stuff on Instagram that I follow. And, you know, a couple guys that come to mind are like Sasha Slipanoff, yeah. He's a great friend, and his work is just unbelievably cool, and he always has his stuff out there. And Art Martins, and you know, that guy's stuff is so rad. And I mean, there's just so many talented people out there, man, and there's so much talent, and there's so many people that are able to do this, and I hope more people do. I hope more people do it. But I would say, yeah, share your work, build it, and don't worry so much about how you're going to do every single step.
Yeah.
People think like maybe I was born with a silver spoon or something, but that's not the case at all. And a lot of it was, you know, family, friends, like pooling together resources, whether it be financial or just time, elbow grease. Yeah. You know, like at friends helped me out, like detailing the car, like every little detail. But I think if you put your work out there and your friends and family get inspired by what you're doing, then you're building something right there, you know. But if you don't start and you don't show people what you're doing, then you're not going to be able to build that kind of, you know, you won't be able to inspire other people to join in on the vision.
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, I think this is the really, really big advantage of this kind of, you know, age of social media, because, you know, yeah. I think this, the kind of idea of inspiration that comes with the social, with social media is absolutely incredible. I mean, you just mentioned Sasha, but like, you know, like it, just look into, you know, before we started recording, we were talking about Alain Durosier a little bit and Gigi Mignon, yeah, who did like the 908 Porsche yeah. concept. Like, you know, this is obviously I think they did a quarter scale or something like that, or like a third scale model then in the end of the whole thing. But I remember when that hit and like everybody over, you know, on Facebook was just completely in awe. Like, oh, guys, this is amazing. Like, you know, Porsche then in the end featured it. And it's just a bunch of guys that, you know, love what they're doing. And in the end, I think, you know, obviously that the time investment from their perspective was the biggest, but it inspired then again a bunch of other people to do it, and, you know, to do their own projects, do their own, like, you know, 3D models. With nowadays, with, you know, video games and VR, you can put out just stuff there and the people can look at it and can feed it back to you and stuff. And I think, you know, with what you've done, I mean, this has taken it even a step ahead, and, you know, really building the whole car, you are really in the middle of this kind of generation, with, you know, new ideas, with kind of sharing the work and stuff like that, because we do see this massive split, you know, and you do see like people comment on it, they like it, they maybe even if they don't like it, they give you criticism, but it's constructive criticism and stuff like that, you know. It's just an incredible kind of time to share all these things, and just it's almost like, you know, going back to the 70s, like, you know, share the love with everything and stuff. But I think this is what really refreshes the car industry at the moment, because let's be very honest, and it sounded to me a little bit, it was one of the reasons for you why you left the traditional industry is you're just getting bored. It's doing the same thing all over again. And obviously you have some few projects, but you're almost in a rut, you know. And with sharing the work nowadays on social media, it's kind of like getting out of the rut and showing the people what other things people think of.
Yeah. And you can be yourself. And that's probably the third thing that when you ask for advice, I would say, just be yourself. Mm-hmm. Don't try to do what you think people are going to want you to do. Just be yourself. Like, when I think of those people, like Sasha's a perfect example. That motherfucker's himself. You know what I mean? Like, he's an original, you know? And I just, that's what I love, just seeing people be themselves. And yeah, it's completely such a great time right now where you can do that. When you're kind of hidden inside of a car company, it's hard to do that. And I grew up, you know, skateboarding and, you know, just hip hop head, and just like that kind of culture was always about being yourself,
yeah,
and finding a way to do something unique, find a unique line, you know, find something, a way to express yourself. So I think the corporate culture just was not, I couldn't wear it for too long. It didn't fit me well. So I really do feel like the kind of the modern era that we're in is so wonderful for that. Like, I mean, Daniel Simon, another one that comes to mind, is just works just so inspiring and mind blowing. And yeah. I'm so happy that there's a tool where he can just keep sharing his stuff, you know? And for us to be, all be able to enjoy it and be inspired and kind of keep the creative juices flowing. And, you know, not only that, but there's also just the 3D tools that we have now that are so wonderful. I was able to print some really large 3D print, some very large parts on that car, like the side mirrors and the headlight buckets. Those were all 3D printed pieces. And, you know, I machined out the molds. My friend Lou in California machined those. And, you know, there was a lot of handwork too, but a lot of that, those 3D digital tools are just so wonderful for creating things quickly and, or a lot more quickly than it would be. And it's, you know, all by hand and it's all very inspiring stuff that, we can take a hold of right now and just do it. I don't think we have to wait for anyone's permission. We just create it, do it.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's also, I mean, this is the big point about 3D printing nowadays. It is relatively cheap. You know, like you don't have to think too much about the costs. Like, you know, it's coming out in the right way. You know, it is pretty much exactly what you want to do. And this is another level of freedom, is now you don't have to go, you know, to like, you know, a workshop and stuff like that, and really have to learn how to weld things and stuff. Like, it's really about, like, you know, you can do simple things. I mean, you know, look at, I have a, you know, a friend of mine, Sebastian Todenrod, who's working as an interior designer at Byton. You know, he does these little wooden cars, and I think he did like a 3D print of one of them, just to kind of see if everything works and stuff like that. And the 3D print was done in like, you know, like, I don't know, like an hour or so, like, you know, the whole thing, including wheels and everything. And you just like, man, like, you know, for those kind of guys, like, you know, that look for the inspiration, that want to create something new, that's incredible tools nowadays. You know, it gives
it's so incredible, man. I'm in awe of it. And there's ways to find compromises too. Like the mirrors, for example, I made those, I did them FDM, you know, that process that's fluid deposition modeling, I think it stands for, rather than SLA printing. I suspect a lot of the designers know what I'm talking about, but an FDM process is less expensive, you know, when you want to make a huge part. And then I went and hand finished it, you know, so I was able to have a compromise where I was able to put in some of my time, you know, and get a part less expensive and faster. Yeah, if I was working in the car industry, I would just send it right to the SLA printer, you know, the high def SLA, you know. But I didn't have that luxury, but I did have a middle ground where I was able to 3D print this huge piece, and that did help, you know, help tremendously. So like, there's ways to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, that's great. And I want to ask you something. And if you don't want to answer this question, that's totally fine by me. But, you spoke about Daniel Simon before as being an inspiration, and he obviously went down a certain kind of route when it comes to, like, you know, as being a designer. Like, he is really he's not just a car guy anymore. Like, you know, he has a passion for cars, but he does all kinds of things nowadays. Now, what's the plan of Carlos Salaf for, you know, maybe your company, obviously, like doing the C1 and the C3, but what are your plans? What can we expect from you? It sounds like, let's say, obviously never say never, to quote a lovely James Bond movie about this, but it doesn't really sound to me that you want to go back into the industry in a traditional way.
No, not at all. I want to keep creating. I want to keep delighting people with cars and keep making them in the way I described earlier at the beginning of the show, just in very much a handmade kind of way where it's this direct connection with the customer. But I do want to explore many other types of design. Yes, cars are a passion. I believe they'll always be, but there's just so many other things that interest me. I'm very interested with aviation, mm-hmm. where aviation's headed. I've always loved airplanes since I was a little kid. And that's one area I'm very curious about. I would say I'm kind of a vehicle head when it comes to design, and there's something about motion and speed that has always captivated me, and I want to keep designing in that space. So definitely aircraft and beyond that, you know, where are we going outside of Earth, and you know, those areas really fascinate me, and I would love to take part in those types of projects.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've discussed it in a podcast already, but like, you know, we see more of these kind of Uber, like, you know, air taxis. We have obviously, but you know, here in Germany, like in Munich in particular, we have Lilium, where Frank Stevenson, former McLaren yes. guy, took over yep. and stuff like that. You know, we see that this is becoming more and more, and a lot of car guys really want to move into that. And I can only speculate, and I'm going to ask you the question, is that because, let's say, you, from a traditional point of view, don't like the idea of autonomous driving in terms of what's ahead of us, because it takes away a lot of the actual experience of obviously driving a car? It becomes more like a carriage, pretty much.
I wouldn't say specifically because of that. I would like to design an autonomous car at some point and think about it as architecture instead of a car. I think we've probably got to stop fighting it and be like, you know what? This is now an interior design project, you know, mm-hmm. and an architectural space. And that would be cool. But I still want to curate. I hope we don't lose driving. I hope we don't lose that joy and the C2 and the C1 and some of the things I've been doing with my own company have been kind of love letters to that kind of thing. And I hope we never lose that. But at the same time, I would love to explore. I'm not like resisting the future. And I think it's inevitable that, you know, electric propulsion and, you know, autonomous transportation will be our future. And I'm very interested in those projects and would like to take that same kind of thinking to the sky as well. And yeah, I think for a car guy, so to speak, that kind of translation is a natural one, because you're already thinking about this moving sculpture and you're already thinking about the romance of the vehicle and all of that. And you're just bringing it to a different place, really.
Yeah.
Different medium.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I do really have to say, I think we could continue for hours and hours and hours, but I think, you know, we've been like, you know, a little bit over 40 minutes, and I want to ask you three questions to finish it, to finish the podcast from my perspective. And my first question to you, who is the most inspirational designer, and it doesn't need to be a transportation designer, just a general designer is also okay, that has influenced your work?
Oh, that's a good question. There's so many. I would say that Zaha Hadid mm-hmm. blew my mind, and still just anything that studio does continues to blow my mind. The way that she redefined structure, and not only the design of it, but the thinking behind the engineering of it, the way engineering and design really are one thing. And yeah, I would say her work has been the most inspiring to me.
Cool. Question number two, if you'd have an infinite amount of money available, which car would you buy? This is a tricky one. I know this, but
oh man, infinite amount of money, what car would I buy? God. I'd probably buy an old race car, like maybe like that Indy Turbine car, or I know I only got one, but I'm starting to think about
I give you two as well. I give you two if you want to.
That's probably insane. The Brabham the fan car, the suction car. Oh man, can you imagine? Yeah, there's some pretty wild stuff that I would want to experience. It's more about the experience, I'd say. Something like that.
Cool. Yeah. And last question. If you could travel back in time, in which decade would you want to live to design the cars?
The 60s in Europe.
In Europe. Not the American 60s.
No, there was some cool stuff. I mean, like the Corvette Stingray. It's beautiful. But Italian design in the 60s is always, for me, it's been the most beautiful and inspiring. And not just car design, but just design. Just fashion design, architecture, you know, obviously the Bauhaus movement, but that's starting earlier. So
yeah, that's a little bit earlier.
But the '60s is a fascinating era to me. Just the Saarinen design and the obsession with space and the way that that influenced everything, furniture and interiors. And I love artwork from that time, really kitschy artwork from that time.
Yeah.
People are flying around like the Jetsons and chilling in tulip chairs. And it just makes me feel so happy.
There we go. I mean, you know, I cannot really add anything to that. I do love the 60s as well in terms of an era. And, you know, there is, let's say, we will come back to you at some point in the future, because I'm very, very much hoping that we will see more from you very, very soon, hopefully sooner than later, the C1 or the C3. And when that happens, we will do another podcast, and obviously we will talk about maybe how, you know, how you've like improved your processes, you know, what you've, you know, brought to the development process from what you've learned now from the C2. But, when we do that, I'm very much looking forward to that. But thank you very much, Carlos, for taking the time. It was an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. And, it's been truly inspiring. And, once again, absolutely fantastic work, that you have delivered, recently at Pebble Beach.
Thank you, Martin. Pleasure to be here with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And, to all our listeners, next time you will probably hear us, Eric will be back from holiday, and, we will very, very likely preview the LA Motor Show, in that sense. Unfortunately, Carlos, you won't be in LA. Is that right for the show?
I can't make it this time, unfortunately.
Too bad. But so we will preview the LA Motor Show. And once again, thank you to Carlos for this very special episode of the Gestalten Podcast. And we will be back very, very soon with another special edition. Thank you very much. Take care, guys. Bye.